Everybody, welcome back to Nobody No Problem. This is Katie.
And I'm Kristen.
And once again, talking about murder. It's like it never gets old.
It's just a vicious like circle of life, people.
Yeah, right. I'm so old.
So, welcome to the new week. It's Friday. Cheers, Kristen.
Cheers, Katie. We survived another week.
We really did.
And we barely did because I'm sure you've all heard on the news, the Midwest got slammed with another blizzard. So now we have about 5 feet of snow outside.
It's insane, actually.
It's beyond me.
I took Sean to get a haircut on Wednesday at Rachel's house, and she had shoveled out... Hey, Rachel.
Hey, Rachel.
She had shoveled out the front walkway, and literally the snow is half of our bodies.
Yep.
I mean, Sean and I are literally, we just figured out, we're the same height right now.
Oh, God, that's
we are
weird.
5.5 feet tall. The body, like, the snow so is half of our bodies. It's insane.
Yeah. I went to go dig my car out because I had to go to work on Tuesday, and that was right after we got, like, the second really big snow. I think they said we got, like, another 12 inches, and I went to go step off my porch, and just, it went directly up to my hip. I was like, oh, cool.
Oh, that's cool.
Good start.
Very casual.
Had to
very
broom casual. Off my car because there was so much. It was, at least it was light snow, though. The first was really heavy.
I totally agree. The first time I shoveled my car out was awful. And, like, I thought I broke my back because I haven't been to a gym in a year. The second snow was so much easier. So,
yeah,
literally,
I
guess no complaints on that part. So.
Yeah, but it's still a frozen tundra where we live. It's great. Lovely.
It's cold. It's cold, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But we're going to keep on keeping on.
We are.
So, whatever.
I hope all of you are doing the same. Surviving. Just keep dreaming of summer.
It's coming.
It's coming.
And normalcy is going to return at one point.
Yeah.
Whenever that is.
Mm-hmm.
So, I just wanted to recap on the episode from last week where I told the story of Vitaly Kaloyev. Wow, that came out a lot smoother than I thought it would. Didn't even practice.
Crushed it.
Wanted to point out, fun fact, there was a movie made in 2017 about this story. Arnold Schwarzenegger starred as Vitaly. I actually watched it this morning so that I could comment on it. I won't comment on much except that they definitely did a based off a true story and everything is different, which happens because they're trying to make money off a movie.
Make it more dramatic. I just don't understand why they changed the amount of people that died because it's...
Yeah, they in the movie it was like over 200, like a significant number over 200 people died. And really, it was, like, 70.
Right. 72, if I remember correctly.
And obviously, they based it in the United States because that's where we mostly film movies that are big here.
What?
So that's...
Well, based on a true story.
Right, so. Exactly. Yeah. But also, for those of you who don't know, I have a friend who I consider a sister named Sarah. She came to live with us as a foreign exchange student when I was in 7th grade.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Sarah. Obviously, she listens to the podcast, and she sent me a few messages, actually, which had me laughing my ass off with the last episode. But there was one specific audio message that I wanted to play for everyone because the topic was
their prison systems.
Prison systems in Europe versus prison systems here.
Which obviously she would have more knowledge about.
Yes, she lives in Germany. So I'm just going to play that real quick. Let's have a listen. Here we go.
Somehow, except for the people died, obviously. But killing understand his distress. But yeah, we do mostly, that's why our prisons aren't fucked up like your guys. Well, first of all, it's not private prisons. Like, our prisons are state-run, so or country-run or whatever. And they do concentrate on rehabilitation. Of course, there are cases where that's not an option. Like, there's people that are not rehabilitable. Like, it's not like you can't get them back to normal. Obviously, and I can't figure that word out right now. But we do try our best in that concern. And it's much less about making people worse and worse. And there's, even in the prisons, there's pretty good healthcare and psychological care and stuff like that. And people have to keep busy with, or can keep busy with, like, stuff that keeps their mind busy, not just stupid work, but it's, like, widespread that you can do things to improve yourself and not get mentally sick and physically sick while in prison, because the target is to release a person that's not gonna re-offend and can be a productive member of society. So having that as a target, of course, sets up the prison system completely different than what you guys have, where it really is about punishment. So, yeah, just to confirm that hunch, you are right about that one.
All right, so as we just heard, I was right. Just kidding, that's not what we're taking away from it. Although it is noted. It is noted.
It is noted. We noted. Kate is correct.
But I mean, we did hear from Sarah that only serving 2 years is pretty wild. Yeah, it is a different setup over there. So I just thought that was an interesting takeaway from last week's episode. So I just wanted to...
Sure, I mean, I think that's
kind of hit on that before we start with your story.
Yeah, I think it's great to kind of get, you know, because our, as we all know, living here, our prison system is very flawed. But I, yes. As she mentioned, I think it has to do a lot with being privately owned and not, you know, run by
the government
who puts you in prison. So I don't think it makes sense. But either way, I thought that that was a cool, a cool little excerpt on our story last week, since it involved Germany and multiple other countries over there.
Yeah. So thank you, Sarah.
Yes, thank you, Sarah. Miss you. Hope all is well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it. What else? Nothing really other than working on this story. It's been a long time coming. It's a long story. There's a lot of information, as we know, on previous episodes where I do deep dives in. I dive deep. So it's
a lot. Put your scuba gear on. We're going in.
We're going in. It is, I don't even know how I remember how I stumbled upon this murder, but I think it was the book. So I saw the book and just kind of got hooked. And it is a crazy story. So I am going to start. So today we are going to talk about the murder of Betty Gail Brown.
Oh my God, no way.
Do you know it?
No.
I don't know, though. Like, I kind of wanted
to... I don't know off the name. I just wanted to pull you. You always know what I'm going to talk about. I know. So I was like, I'm ready for it.
That's the thing. Is I, like, I have to hear the story for a little bit, but then it's like, you know, we were talking about the Cecil Hotel, and I was like, that's the one where the girl, like, jumped into the vat of water, and they don't know if she killed herself or she got murdered, right? And I was like, yeah. Like, it's just kind of like, you know.
Yep. It's back there in the...
Right. My crazy murder brain, there's just stuff stored in there. I don't know.
Yep. But okay. So go ahead. I'm excited.
Betty Gail Brown was born May 4th, 1942, as an only child to Hargis Taylor Brown and Quincy Alice Brown in Madison County, Kentucky. Her father was a life insurance salesman, and her mother was a housewife, but also had a side hustle as an interior designer.
So, oh, hell yeah. Yeah, that's right? That side hustle I like to see. Come right? Fix my house.
Uh-huh. Love it. Betty lived a very typical middle-class life. She was super well-liked. Nothing crazy happened. Very typical. You know, kind of like our lives. It's just like they played in the streets and she had friends and, you know, it was a smaller area, so all that good stuff. So she graduated as an honors student from Lafayette High School and ended up attending Transylvania, or Transy as the students call it, college, which is one of the oldest higher learning institutions in the country. It is the oldest one in Kentucky. It was actually founded in, I think they said 1760. And it was well known because a lot of 2 vice presidents, 2 senior court justices, and 1 of the generals from the Civil War actually attended it. So.
And you go there to major in becoming a vampire. Am I correct? Or am I correct?
I don't know why it's called Transylvania College, but it is. So Transy.
I'm a child, so that's where my mind goes.
Dracula founded it, apparently. But Transy is what they call it. She was very well-liked. She was super hardworking. She was very smart. She was involved in choir and went to church. And she was involved in a sorority. Well-known. It was a very small college, though. There was only 600 or 700 students.
Oh, my God. That is really small.
Which is less than our high school.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
Most of the students lived in the dorms, but Betty lived at home with her parents because she lived about, I think they said it was like a 10-minute, 15-minute drive.
Oh, hell
so
yeah.
Very close.
Save on those rooming costs.
Save some moolah, you know? You gotta. So on October 26, 1961, Betty was a sophomore at Transy. She woke up, she had breakfast with her family, and then headed to school. She saw some friends, she studied, she did her thing at school, and then came back home for dinner, which was typical. Betty then headed back to school to attend, or was planning on going back to school to attend a study session with some of her sorority sisters at Foyer Hall. So I guess she had a big biology exam the next day. So she talked to her parents. She said she'd be home by 11-ish. She suggested to her parents to go see a movie at the drive-in because I guess she had went the other day and she was like, Dad, you'd like this, so you guys should go.
Sure.
So her parents were like, that sounds like a wonderful idea. So around 7, her parents headed out and Betty shortly thereafter. Betty made it to Foyer Hall and found her friends and they were all there. They met, went to study hall. Around 10 o'clock, they took a break. Betty parted from her friends to find the house mother, or they call it a house mother back then, I'm assuming. It's just an RA.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's pretty normal.
Yeah.
I mean, even at sororities, they have a house mother.
She asked to stay at Old 12 because it was past visiting hours, but she was a student, so the RA was like that, or the house mother was like, that's fine. So she was given permission to stay until midnight. At 11:55, Betty Gale said goodbye to the house mother, thanked her for letting her stay late, said goodbye to her friends, and she headed home.
Did she make it home?
As Betty was getting into her car, she ran into one of her old friends, Charles Risden, and as he was getting into his car after a date in the parking lot. So he, like, pulled up to her car, she rolled on the window, he was like, hey, how's it going, whatever, stopped to chit-chat with Betty, and they both parted ways. He stated that they only spoke for a few minutes. He drove to the end of the driveway. He turned onto Broadway. As he left, he saw that Betty was following him, which was typical because that was the way she took home. He then turned onto Upper Street and then pulled into Morrison Hall, which is his dorm. Betty drove past him and he could see her car leave. That was the last time he saw her, and he stated it was around 12:05 a.m. It looked like she was heading home, so no big deal.
Oh, man.
Betty's parents arrived home from the movie around 10:30 p.m. Betty's father apparently wasn't feeling very well, so he went to bed, took some aspirin, went to sleep. But her mom, who was super close with Betty because she was an only child, decided to wait up. Her mom stated a lot that she never really went to bed until Betty got home, which is, this is super sweet. I guess it was a cold night, so she actually went into Betty's room and got a heating pad ready for her and was just, like, kind of chilling in Betty's bed, like, looking at magazines.
Oh, my heart.
I know. Waiting for her daughter to get home. So around 12, Betty's mom started to get, like, a little, okay, she said she'd be home by 11 if she's not home. But she knew the dorms closed at 12. So 15-minute drive, so she was kind of like, okay, maybe she just decided to stay late. It's fine. So by 12:40, she was really starting to get worried.
Yeah. I mean, as a mother, I would.
Yeah. She started to get a little bit, you know, anxious about her daughter not being home yet, which, as you said, totally understandable. So she decided to get in her car and go look for Betty since, you know, Transy was not far from their home. So she knew where she was. So she checked Foyer Hall, and then which was closed, and then checked the parking areas around it. No Betty. So she retraced the route that Betty would have taken on the way home. No Betty. Once she arrived home, no Betty. So she decided to head back out and search a different route that she could have taken for whatever reason.
Badass mama.
She is. On the prowl. Still no Betty. Her mom drove home hoping that Betty would be there. Nothing. So now it was around 2 a.m. She decided it was time to wake up her husband.
Yep.
He got out of bed, and he was kind of like in the beginning, like, she probably stopped to get something to eat with her friends. It's fine. You know, she's a college student. She's a sophomore, so, you know,
she needs a little bit of space.
Exactly. He eventually was like, okay, I'll do what I can. So he got out of bed and started calling local police departments, asking about car accidents, if any of them. Her car was a 1959 gray Simca. There was nothing. So he called hospitals, any of the, some of the major hospitals around the area. Nothing. He then called Foyer Hole and asked if anyone had seen her. He actually spoke to the house mother and stated that she had left before midnight. So after this, Betty's father was like, shit.
Yep.
So then, yeah, I'm sure at this point he's freaking out. So I'm setting it up. So at that point, he called the state and local police department. Betty's officially missing. Gave them a description of her car and her license plate number. The police put out an all units broadcast and began to search for Betty Gale and her car. The parents began calling her friends. They actually started calling diners to see if there were, like, kids there.
Literally anything. Yeah. Anything.
Anywhere. They started calling. Betty never had a boyfriend, but she was kind of like, she went on a couple dates. Apparently, she liked a football player that went to Kentucky University. University of Kentucky, sinner. Whatever. All right. He called the football house. Nobody answered. So Betty's friends, I'm assuming at her sorority, did answer and gave her parents the same story as the house mother. She was here. She studied with us. She left around 12. We haven't seen her since. So Betty's father is now freaking out. So he takes the car and goes and starts to search for Betty. He got home around 3. Still no sign of Betty. So they flip-flopped, and then Betty's mom got back in the car and decided to search the campus again. So at this point, the police had been out looking for Betty and any sign of her car. Detective Donald Duckworth responded and started to question students at Foyer Hall with no luck, then started to search the campus. He drove around the campus until he spotted a small car parked outside Morrison Hall.
No.
He pulled over, approached the car that met the description, and saw that there was a person in the driver's seat.
No.
He found Betty Gale in the driver's seat. It appeared that there was a bra hanging around her neck. Ugh. He noticed that she was not moving or breathing, and that the student was deceased.
We knew it was going to happen. We talk about murder, but it still sucks.
Yeah, I mean, it really does. It's just, it's always sad when it's just, you know, someone who's this young and seemed to be such a wonderful person.
Like a bright person.
Yes, just right. A wonderful person.
Go ahead. So, give me the nitty gritty.
He did not attempt to enter the car as to not disturb the body or evidence that may exist.
Oh, good on ya.
Good on ya.
That does not always happen.
It doesn't, and I think that if a little bit of me went like, damn, because what if you could save her? But I think she was deceased. I think
you know someone is dead.
Yeah,
dead.
I think he was like, she's not alive. Sure. She's not breathing, she's not moving, there's no way, you know.
Especially, you said he's a detective?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got experience.
Yes.
Yeah.
He then radioed into the police station. They sent backup, as well as 2 detectives, Captain Gilbert Cravens and Captain Brian Henry, and the coroner, Chester Hager. Oh, this is the part that got me. Betty's mom was still searching when an officer found her to tell her the news.
Oh, no.
She was outside Betty's sorority when they told her. They escorted Betty's mom home, and they had to tell Betty's dad. It was actually very sweet. Like, the girls, the officer obviously told her what happened, and the girls at the sorority were like, oh, my God, what do we do? And so the officer was like, you get in my car. And the girls were like, we'll drive her car home. So they, like, followed because, aww, you know, yes, they were. But, I mean, those were her friends,
what the friends would do.
Yes. Okay, so they pulled Betty's dad, obviously, and it went as horribly as you would think.
Yep.
So, the crime scene. They found Betty sitting upright with her feet on the floor and her head tilted back against the seat, almost facing the roof of the car. What I understood, it was almost like it's not the way that anybody who was living would be looking.
An unnatural position.
Okay. That's what I was looking for. So, Betty appeared to have a small cut or bruise on her forehead. There was blood around the wound as well as on the dashboard of her car. She had had her bra wrapped around her throat and had deep bruising around her neck. It appears there was a little bit of a struggle, but not much. If I am assuming someone knocked her out before any of that could really happen.
I mean, unfortunately, that's the smartest thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, I just hope she wasn't in pain. But either way, the detective noticed that all the doors were locked except for one passenger side door, which the first detective didn't notice. But apparently there was like a malfunction with one of the passenger side door lock. I'm not really sure. They didn't really dive into it, but they said there could have been there's a possibility that it didn't lock. But that will come into play later. Detectives were able to put together that Betty was wearing all of the same clothes that she had left her house in, and they were all undisturbed other than the top two buttons on her blouse that were unbuttoned and her bra was off, obviously.
All right, so if you're going to take away a good thing, it's that no rape happened.
Yes.
Hate to say it, but we've told too many stories. Like, if you're going to kill me, kill me. Don't rape me first.
Yep. Okay. Yes, yes. So, and then sorry,
continue.
So that's the next point. Is this the lead detectives believe that the motive for this murder was not sexual or rape related. In the car, they found Betty's school supplies, keys, and purse, including her wallet, which means it also wasn't robbery related.
Someone just wanted to kill her.
This is where I'm reading the book, or I'm listening to this book, and I'm like, what the fuck happened? This is why I was so into it, you know?
Sure.
Why? Yep. Why? So they checked the surrounding area for more clues, found nada. They actually said they found a gold watch, like, within the area, but it wouldn't have made sense to have been Betty's because she was wearing her watch. So it was probably just someone lost it or something.
Sure.
They then had the car moved to the police station to be fingerprinted and to do a more thorough investigation for clues. Betty was then sent to be autopsied, and as well as her clothes were to be, you know, thoroughly investigated. So the autopsy. Upon examining Betty, not much more was discovered other than the cause of death, which was fairly obvious. The cut on her forehead was listed as superficial, and they also found small cuts on her face as well as some bruising around one of her eyes. Could have been when someone slammed her head into the dashboard, because that's probably what happened. Almost all of her injuries were located around her neck, which had tearing and swelling as well as broken bones and a crushed larynx in the neck, which, as we know, that'll kill you.
That'll do it.
Yeah. They did find food in her stomach. They didn't know what it was exactly, and they couldn't tell exactly when it was eaten because of the stage of digestion. They found out Betty was on her period. I will bring that up
as to why I brought that up.
Yes, I will. Right. There's a reason why I brought it up, and I actually put in parentheses, explain why you brought that up. They also ruled out any sexual assault or rape. They put Betty Gale's death at 1:15 a.m., just over 1 hour after Betty had left the transit campus. Cause of death was listed as strangulation by external force, obviously. It doesn't make any sense to me how this happened or why it happened. This is why I was so into this, and I deep dive, like, I was like, what the hell happened? You know what I mean?
Yep.
So, examination of her clothes and or car. They found lipstick smears on her shorts as well as a few pieces of human hair. Also, why was there lipstick on her shorts?
I like my shorts all the time. I usually just don't wear lipstick.
Just rub it all off on your shorts while you're wearing them? Like, did she... That's what... It was so confusing to me.
If I could bend that far forward.
That's what I'm like, what? Okay. Yeah. This is... Okay. Just remember that. Upon examination of her car, they found blood in three places. The rear floorboard, the driver's side window, and the passenger side dashboard. They took samples and sent them out, all found to be Betty's. They fingerprinted the car, found 3 clear fingerprints that didn't belong to Betty. The search for suspects begins.
Here we go.
Detectives attempted to find any witnesses or anyone that could help piece Betty's timeline together. So a better timeline of where she was, what she did, you know, if anyone had seen her after she was alone in her car. Most interviews were all the same. She was studying, she didn't eat, and when she left the dorm, she gave all the impressions that she was just going home. It was very sad. Everybody just was heartbroken. Everyone said that she was a wonderful person and she was very well loved and didn't have, you know, she was just a good, decent human being.
That's too bad.
Detectives were able to narrow down 2 things after talking to her best friends. 1, that she was very strict about locking her car doors and would have never let a stranger inside. Most likely knew her killer. That's kind of where my head goes at that. But who knows? And what? 2, that when she was on her period, which is why I brought it up, she removed her bra because your boobs hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a thing. So sorry for any male listeners, but it's a real thing.
Yeah.
They get very tender.
And it hurts. And I don't know how comfortable bras were back in the freaking 60s.
I mean, they're not super comfortable now.
No,
so
they're not. So that's why I brought up that she was on her period, because the bra is her murder weapon. So that could be why the bra was available to do that.
Okay.
So it doesn't necessarily mean it was forced off of her body. It could have been removed.
She could have been like, fuck this, I'm out of the library, freeing my girls.
Exactly.
And then the murderer was like, hey-o.
Right.
Easily available murder weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Strangle you, bitch.
Yes, exactly. What she said. Charles Ryden, as we mentioned before, actually walked into the police department to give his statement, who was the last person known to see Betty Gale alive, as far as they know. Obviously, other than her murderer. So he actually walked into the police department and was like, hey, I'm going to tell you this because I don't want to be involved in this or whatever. At first, I was like, suspish. And then I was like, no. So he told his story. Like I said, they believed he was one of the last people to see her alive. He was eventually brought back in and interrogated, then given a lie detector test and passed. And then he was brought back in again and interrogated. He had an alibi. They checked out his story. He lived in a dorm. Tons of people saw him there at 12. She was murdered at 1:15, it just
didn't honestly, good on him for going in and being like, listen, this is what I know. Mm-hmm. This was my friend.
And that's what...
Trying to...
Yeah, and that's kind of what they said. Was that he seemed to be, you know, they were a little suspicious at first, which I get it.
Sure, anyone would be.
Right, I totally get it.
But good that they were able to conclusively rule him out.
And they were really able to break down, like, he really gave them the ability to break down where she was at the last, because he pulled into Morrison Hall, which was his dorm, and she drove past him.
Right.
So he knew the road that they now know, the road that she was driving down, at what point. Right. I mean, it did look like she was very going helpful. Home, but yes, it really was. So good on you, Charles. That's pretty much the only information they have on what she was doing between the hours of 12:05 and 3 a.m.
Okay.
However, so they seem to have been doing a pretty good job, but this is where things go off the rails a little bit for me. I understand that they don't have the technology that we have, and there was fucking no evidence. Nothing. I mean, there was really nothing that they could go on. I don't know why, but they contacted the newspapers and gave them everything. And I mean everything that they had.
Oh,
current to this investigation.
To withhold some stuff, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, because if people come forward and make a confession, you have to be able to say,
line this... it up against what you know versus what the public knows.
Exactly, because if this person knows everything that something that hasn't been released to the public, they obviously did it. But they released everything. I mean, crime scene photos. They actually released the photo of her dead in her car.
Oh my god.
Yeah. I mean.
If that was my family member, I'd be pissed.
Yeah. Oh, I would be livid.
Like, no, that's private.
Yep. There was photos of her car. There was all the way down to how many doors were locked. Like, I mean, they released everything to the public.
Major fuck up.
Yeah, I feel like at that point, they were probably just, like, driving the public to help them. Maybe someone could come forward.
Sure.
But we all know what happens when this stuff like this is released and handled this way is that 99% of the people come forward are whack jobs, and they have nothing that's concrete substantial. And they're all, like, made up stuff, and all of the man hours and police hours and all the things that are wasted on bad stuff when you could be taking your efforts on good stuff. I guess at this point, I could see why they needed to do it because they had nothing to fucking go on.
But you leave a trail. You don't give up your entire case. That is
what I was like. You did not need to give up your entire case. I mean, photos. Photos of the car, where the clothes were, who she was last with. Charles Risen's name was released. I mean, everything was released in the papers.
No.
Right. Not huge fan of that concept. But again, it was 1961. There were very limited resources as far as...
And it is what it is. We cannot go back and redo time.
Yes. So, 2 days later, after seeing Betty's picture in the paper, a witness came forward saying that Betty had come into her diner around 12:15, and she waited on her and another woman.
Oh.
They ordered some drinks and left together. So one had ordered hot cocoa, Betty ordered tea, they drank, the other woman paid, and they left. They then took the waitress to Foyer Hall to see if she could identify the girl that Betty was with in the diner. Nada. They actually let her attend the funeral service as well to see if she could recognize anyone. Nada. A few days later, however, a few boys came forward and said they were in this restaurant where the waitress worked and that Betty Gale was not there, as they were friends with her and would have said hi. So I guess it was around the time that she was claiming that Betty was in the diner.
Okay.
A few days after that, another waitress came forward and said that Betty Gale was present in their restaurant and had left with a male.
Wait a minute. Where really was she?
This is why you don't do those things, folks. Same thing happened with this server. She was shown photos and identified Betty, but could not identify the male. Both ended up going nowhere. Yep. They then started interviewing any of the boys that she had been dating. I would say that's a, you know, good way to go. They were able to get this info through her diary. There was something in her diary that they pulled up that I was kind of like, eh. So apparently she had talked about all the guys that she had not dated. I don't want to make her sound like she's floozy or anything, because she was not. She
floozy.
Did not.
For those of you of the younger generation, is a slut.
Is one of those people who sleep around. She was
they just offer their hoo-ha's out to anyone.
Betty was the polar opposite end of that spectrum. She did not do that. She was very, and the boys who dated her were very, so this guy in the book I was reading said that sometimes they would kiss and maybe there was a little petting.
Oh my god. It sounds like,
quote unquote, for the Who Killed Betty Gale Brown
sounds
Robert
like
Lawson
a
book.
Pornography.
A little petting.
Brought
I was like,
to life.
What do you mean petting? So she was very strict about keeping herself clean till marriage, you know, back in the 60s, whatever.
That
so.
Makes me think of The Office when Andy starts dating Angelica.
Oh,
and he goes, we're necking, but literally we're rubbing our necks.
Creepy. I wonder if they were just actually petting each other.
Maybe.
Like just petting each other.
Okay, that's weird. Nope, don't like that.
But she was very, she was known to be very respectable. And they also said that she did not like taking her car out when she was on dates. She preferred the gentleman to pick her up, which kudos on you.
Hell yeah.
Save on that gas money, girl.
Hell yeah.
So that kind of went nowhere. They actually contacted the guy that was mentioned the most, who was a football player that went to University of Kentucky, which University of Kentucky and Transylvania College are literally a couple blocks apart. So
okay. Yeah.
He, not even close to being a suspect, had an alibi, was like, we were supposed to see each other Saturday, whatever. Didn't even, that was it. But it was strange to me that she mentioned a newly married man in her diary quite a few times.
I thought she was not a sinner.
They could just be friends. Girlfriend. Could be jumping the gun. But, you know.
Anywho.
He's in her diary, guys. I mean. He made the cut. So I was like, ew, red flag. But also, you never know. Maybe they were just friends. Who knows? So basically, again, didn't go anywhere. The investigators also got multiple other leads, which this is where things get, when I say hundreds, I mean hundreds of leads a day. And there, at this point in the 60s, there isn't like a CODIS or something that you could type in, like, who is this person that's reporting this information, if they give you their information? Who are the people that they're, you know what I mean? Like, sure. There's a breakdown of information that you have at your disposal.
They put it in this kind of Rolodex.
Right. And they have to entertain these people until these leads die out. So at this point, it's just insane what they have to deal with. But again, that's why the processes that they went through with releasing all this information on the paper is not a good idea. So I'm going to break down some of the main ones, but the investigators also got multiple other leads, such as screams around the time Betty was killed around Morrison Hall. Questions were asked. Nothing supported this other than the one person who heard it. So it could have been anybody. Someone says they saw a man walking down the driveway on Morrison Hall that no one recognizes close to the time that Betty was killed. Someone saw a man who was 6 feet tall in glasses and a flannel that was walking down the street around 2 a.m. That's rare. No one recognized. So, especially because they're on campus still, so you have to, understand that a college of 700 people, everyone kind of knows each other. So if you don't recognize this person, you're going to stand out.
Well, and also, as much as we hate all the dead leads, awesome that people were
trying to help.
Yes. I mean, at 2 a.m. on a college campus, who is sober enough to remember that there was someone rando walking down the street?
I mean, honestly, and I don't really
God bless.
How crazy people got back then, but I'm sure there was crazy parties. I'm sure it was a lot of fun.
70s? I'm
61.
Yeah, 60s, 70s.
That's that fun time. I mean, it was Kentucky. It's not like it was Haight-Ashbury or anything, but, San Francisco.
It doesn't matter where you are. You can have a good time.
I'm sure there was plenty of parties happening. But yeah, there was a lot of those.
Good on ya.
Yes. A lot of those.
Thanks for trying.
Someone said that a guy had approached her in a car, and she was sitting in her window, and her window was rolled down, and he was like, hey, honey, what are you doing tonight? And she was like, no.
No.
And then she said he had a wild look about him. Like, it was just.
See, I would do the same thing. If I knew that someone had just gotten murdered and a creepo came up to my car window.
Right.
Fuck yes.
Yes.
You know what? Even just in case.
Yeah, exactly. So people were trying to help, and I think because it was such a small community that it was...
Even more so.
Right.
Of a ramp up of help.
Yeah. So I think everyone was trying. I don't think anyone did this in a bad, with bad intentions.
No. But,
so investigators were doing all that, and then they finally got the fingerprints back. So, obviously, you're in a vehicle, and it's a college girl's vehicle, so there's going to be a bajillion fingerprints everywhere. They got 3 fingerprints back that were clear enough to lift. So, now, basically, what they're doing is they're setting up a fingerprinting campaign for all the students at Transylvania College, which is a huge undertaking. I mean, that's 700 people, so they get that started. This is what drove me crazy, is that they started this before they, narrowed down, got rid of, what do they call that when you give your DNA? Rule out. Before they ruled out.
I would have helped, but I had no idea what you were going for.
Yes, so they did this before they ruled out some of the most consistent people in her life. The 3 fingerprints they got back that they couldn't identify after they set up this huge undertaking, I think they got halfway through the school, turned out to be her mom's, her dad's, and the mechanic that looked at her car.
No, good.
Recently. So I was like, really?
Good.
Did you guys not rule these people out?
Clearly not.
Right, which is a ton of work and a ton of man hours that were just wasted that could have just been completely negated if they just would have taken fingerprints. Well, I don't know if maybe back then it was, like, rude to do that. Because her parents obviously weren't involved. But it's also, like, again, you gotta somehow cut suspects down, you know?
Yep.
So after this, the investigators are basically shit out of luck. There's no evidence. There's nothing. The case was now just following leads that they received, which were in the hundreds, like I said. There's a million examples. There's a few that some girl said that she was sitting by a tree one night alone, and some guy came up to her and said, "I'm the Transylvania Strangler. You better come with me." And she said, "I'm not going anywhere with you." And then some guy walked up, and she was crying at this point, and then this guy kind of fled the scene. So that was brought up. I mean, there was just hundreds of those weird kind of situations that sure. they try to follow up on. But how do you do that? She said he was a red-haired guy, 6 feet, and had glasses.
Oh.
That narrows it down to...
ginger.
That narrows it down to nobody. Well, so
a ginger narrows it down.
I guess, but I mean... Yeah, I guess more so than if he was brown-haired, for sure.
But, yes.
Yes. It broad. You can't really do anything with that. But that's just, like, one example. And the two others that I gave you over, like, hundreds that they have to work. So they then got a tip that somebody that Betty used to study with who lives in Michigan, who dropped out of school shortly after the murder, was a suspect, I guess, now. I don't know why. Because I guess it was suspicious he dropped out of school after the murder. Sure.
Sure. I mean, they're clinging on to anything at this point.
Exactly. So, respect that they're going to do it. So, they actually went up to Michigan. They interviewed this young man for about 4 hours. He basically was like, Betty and I were good friends. She was always so sweet to me. We studied together. Dropping out of school had nothing to do with Betty. The pressure from my parents were too great. And also, I'm a homosexual who was seeing a psychiatrist. So, they were like, okay.
You're out.
So after 4 hours of talking, basically that went nowhere. They interviewed a hitchhiker who was from Chicago who had fresh wounds on his head. Turned out to be nothing. They were a little bit suspicious because he had fresh wounds, and someone had said that he had mentioned something about hurting somebody the night before, but he was staying at the Salvation Army as a homeless person, and you have to sign in at 10. Yep. And you cannot leave. He's the out. Doors are locked from the outside, he's so out. You cannot leave. So he's out. And it's just, it goes on.
And on and on.
And on and on and on. They had another one that was a promising lead that was an employee that worked at Transylvania College. He was a cafeteria worker that lived in Savannah. So they headed down to frickin' Savannah and talked to him. He was a family guy. Everyone liked him. He quit because he was like, I was overworked. I was working 14 hours a day. And then he quit. I think he quit like a week after the murder happened. So suspicious. But then he was like, dude, I had nothing to do with this. Again.
I mean, good that they're following up on leads, but ultimately sad.
Yep.
No outcome.
There's a woman who said her husband did it. Nothing happened. There's multiple people who did all that stuff. And then it got a rumor started that Betty's parents were involved. They were not. They were absolutely 110% not. Someone said that it was like the stupidest thing. Her parents were not involved.
Okay.
They had an alibi. They were clearly not there. They were loving, wonderful people. It makes no sense. No motive. No reason. They loved her very much. Why would... Nada.
Okay. Got it.
Nada.
So we move on.
We move on. So, this is like the first kind of big, they think big break, which I thought was very odd, but I don't know. So... Now we're headed to New York, and it's 1962. The police in New York made an arrest. A large woman that looked to be asleep on a bench was approached by police officers. She was woken up, and as she was woken up, they realized it wasn't a woman, it was a man, and she immediately pulled out a revolver, was disarmed, and arrested. Seemed to have been very drunk. They discovered, obviously, she was a man, which I had to point this out, which I thought was just absurd. So, obviously, she was charged with assaulting an officer and masquerading as a woman was apparently a crime in New York City in 1962.
That actually does not surprise me.
It doesn't. Back then it was not looked, yeah, it was very frowned upon to be in that, so I, whatever.
Hey, welcome to 2021, do you?
Yes. Do you, boo-boo. But I thought it was just insane. I was like, masquerading as a woman was a crime? Okie dokie.
Jesus.
He actually said that he was only dressed as a woman because he was his car was parked outside of this park, and he was trying to find the person who had broken into it several times. Okay.
What does dressing as a woman...
Not sure where
okay,
that connected.
You know what? Maybe he just needed some kind of excuse to be himself.
Yeah.
Or herself.
Yep.
Which is fine.
Whatever they wanted to do. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, because she was masquerading as a woman and was charged, it gave them legal cause to search said person. While they were searching this person, they found an envelope containing clippings regarding the Betty Gill Brown murder that were almost a year old.
Oh, that's not suspicious.
Right? I was like, because in the beginning I was like, okay, they're going to try to, because this person was doing whatever they wanted to do and no one agreed with it. And then I was like, wait, what?
Nope, that's weird.
What? That is very weird.
Can you emphasize that H a little bit more?
Weird.
Weird. And what?
Suspicious. AF. So, I mean, see, it's just, they're a year old. Why do you still have those on you?
Clearly. Also, why did you have them on you at all?
He said that when he gets drunk or drinks, he does weird things.
Okay, well, yeah, a year later, that's highly suspicious.
Right.
Don't be suspicious. Yeah. Don't be suspicious.
God, I love John Ralphio. Oh, and Mona Lisa.
Bless.
Hey. So, he stated that he was a student that graduated from Transy College and that a friend had sent him the clippings. It's still weird that you are carrying them around with you. Bizarre. He stated the clippings, like I said, they were sent to him by a friend, and he had never met Betty. Detectives were like, stay right there.
Okay.
So they contacted the Lexington Police Department, and the Lexington Police Department headed up to interview this person. So they got his name, which was not released, so I'm not sure who it was. He had graduated June of 61, 4 months before the murder of Betty. No behavioral issues were reported in school. He got decent grades, but it wasn't anything to write home about, but he did graduate. But he also wasn't present for the murder of Betty. He was in New York. Detectives attempted to speak with him about specific events to see if he'd ever gone back to Lexington, all this stuff. But his parents, who I guess his dad was a businessman and his mom had a job as well, and they were, I wouldn't say like well off, but they were ritzy enough to get him a lawyer. The lawyer showed up and they were like, he's under psychiatric care. He's currently not feeling well. He's sick. He's on medication, this, that, and the other. So, but at school, they didn't have any of these issues. His parents did make a statement saying that their son, obviously, like I said, was in treatment and that he had never, once he graduated, he had not returned to Lexington. He had not left New York. That was the end of it, which will be corroborated. They found the man who had sent the clippings who lived in Frankfort, Kentucky. They interviewed him for 4 hours. He said that he thought that his friend would want to see what happened since he was a Transy graduate and he was a good friend of him. He also corroborated the story and said, he was one of my best friends here, and if he was in Lexington, he would have called me and told me he's not been back since he graduated. Apparently, this guy had an alibi the night of Betty's murder that was like foolproof. So I don't know if he wasn't in Kentucky or what, but.
So both the guy found in New York and the guy that sent him the clippings are officially ruled out.
Yes.
Suspects.
Yes.
So a whole bunch of nothing here.
So yes, there's a whole bunch of nothing. So now they have traveled to Michigan, New York, Georgia, and all over fucking Kentucky and still have absolutely damn nothing. But then.
What?
But then it takes us to Alex Arnold, a junior.
A junior?
A junior. So, he was 33 years old. He was born in Lexington, Kentucky. He basically grew up there. He was a veteran of the Korean War. He was an alcoholic and served 1 year in jail. He had just gotten out and basically was like a nomad, kind of a hobo-ish, if you will, doing odd jobs and living off others that were willing to help him. He was just kind of traveling across the country. He ended up in Klamath Falls, Oregon. On January 16th, 1965, he got real drunk and ended up getting arrested and prosecuted. So apparently it was just drunk and disorderly in public, the huge. He was sentenced to 10 days in prison as he was given a ticket of $25 and could not pay it because he had no money. So they sentenced him to 10 days in prison.
Sure. Seems fair.
Once he sobered up, things started to get bad as he was withdrawing from alcohol. He was hallucinating and apparently had some conversations with his toilet paper. Just really not good.
I mean, who doesn't?
Who doesn't? He thought that there was a machine implanted in the wall outside of his cell that could read his thoughts. So he was not doing well. He was actually attempted to kill himself. They didn't really specify. I think what they said is he tried to hang himself with a belt. He was put on 24-hour watch. Again, not doing well. I guess it was a week later, and he was probably doing much better because he'd withdrawn already. I mean, I would say that's right before he got out, which you would think he'd be back to normal, right?
You would think.
You would think. He approached a guard and stated he needed to get something off his chest. The guard called the police and was put in contact with the detective. The detective, his name is Detective Lilly, then came down to see Arnold and took him into an interrogation room, as Arnold requested, because he said that there was a recording device that could read his mind outside of his cell.
Mm, yes.
Where Arnold stated that he killed Betty Gale Brown.
And it's hard to say. I wanted to ask, does he know the specifics? But all the specifics were put out.
I'm going to recap his confession. So he stated that he was drinking at a bar and that he left to go to nearby Gratz Park to sleep, but couldn't find any open spots. I guess he had picked up a bottle of wine from a liquor store, and then there was a couple on a bench that he normally crashed at, and he didn't want to sleep there. So he crossed 3rd Street and went into the transit campus. He fell asleep somewhere. About an hour later, he woke up. I guess it was really cold that night, so he woke up because of the cold, finished his wine, and started walking. Spotted Betty's car. And in Betty's car, apparently, there was another woman, and they were making love. See, I'm going to bring it back to why she had lipstick on her shorts. Am I wrong?
No, you're not. That actually makes sense now.
Yeah, because it wasn't hers. But you know, back then, being gay or bi or transsexual or whatever, LGBTQ, any of that was very frowned upon. So that, my head was like right back to the shorts. But
yep.
He knocked on the glass, which is so inappropriate, but he was drunk and fucking weird, and asked for a match to light his cigarette. He then said, they basically bitched him out, but he said they were cussing me. They kept cussing me. So he said that initially, he said sorry and then left, but got mad because he was drunk and went back. He then returned to the car, opened the door on the driver's side. Once he did this, the other woman supposedly fled. Betty had kind of been leaning this way, you know what I mean? Like she was leaning away from him. And sure. As she was leaning, he took her head and bounced it off the dashboard.
All because you needed a light for your cigarette?
Yep.
Listen, I'm a smoker.
Not worth it.
Don't need one that bad.
Yeah, not fucking worth it. Oh, so she was knocked out, essentially. Yes, we know. He then got into the back seat, took her bra, and strangled her as he was scared she would identify him. So what he said was he put his knee in the back of the seat and used her bra to strangle her.
Used it as...
What we... Yes, as a... Yes.
Okay.
So what I didn't bring up was that the bra was pretty much in tatters. Obviously, you would assume it was stretched out. There was a piece of the fabric was ripped off. Choking a human being or strangling a human being takes a ton of strength and muscle and time. You would think movies make it look easier than it is. It's not. Which, it's creepy that I know that, but I feel like all the research I've done on people that have been strangled.
Follows true crime.
Yes. It is not easy to strangle somebody. So it takes a lot of pressure, and you have to be able to hold it. A few things that weren't quite right. He said that he had choked her for about a minute and a half, pulled as hard as he could. He took the bra after he was done with it and put it on the front seat, which does not match what was found when the body was discovered. He then said her shirt was unbuttoned all the way down, and that he didn't want her to be found that way because it would look like he tried to rape her. So he went into the front seat and buttoned her blouse all the way up. There was two buttons unbuttoned on her blouse. So that's, but those are details. I understand that he was drunk, but those are details that, like, are big at this point because everything was released.
You did these things, and the crime scene does not match up. That's huge.
Yes. So big things, like big details. Again, he was drunk, but big details that you would probably remember. So he said that he then wiped down the fingerprints, locked three of the doors, which did match with what the police found, and left. He stated that when he then went to a woman named May Hedges' apartment and told her that he had just killed a woman. They eventually go find her. She's living in Florida. I guess she was an elderly lady that he allowed him to stay with her from time to time when he had nowhere to go. And she would give him like a drink or two and he would sleep on the couch and just leave. They found her in Florida as she had moved by the time all this happened. And she was like, he never said that. I don't recall any of that happening. But again, she was older. Who knows? The detective he was speaking to then ordered a psych evaluation and a physical evaluation of Arnold, and he was declared to be fit and healthy and mentally stable. He then called the Lexington Police Department and had the police department head out to Oregon to interview Arnold. After a few interviews with Arnold and taking his official statement, a warrant for his arrest was issued. Arnold stated that it felt like a 500-pound weight had been lifted from his shoulders. He willingly waived his extradition rights, and they returned to Lexington to await the trial. Arnold's attorney ended up taking the case pro bono. His name was Amos Eblin. He was very well known at the time. He graduated Harvard Law. He had taught at University of Kentucky Law. He was a very well-known, very well-respected defense attorney. So it was good that he got this person. And then Robert Lawson was named as his co-counsel, who was the book that I read a lot of this on. So a lot of what he wrote was based on his personal experience doing all of this. Preliminary trial, his bail was set at $50,000, and he was taken to county jail to await trial. The first day of court lasted 2 hours. There were so many issues with jurors. It was crazy. Like, it was just a mess. So then a full courtroom, fully packed with people, because obviously this was a big deal. Everyone had to leave and come back the next day. Well, I would say the next week because they had to get new jurors in. It was crazy. So when they finally were able to give opening statements, they did their thing. Betty's mom was the first one to take the stand. About as sad as you would think.
Yeah, that sounds
right. She recapped her daughter's personality, who she was as a person, what she did her final hours, all that stuff.
Very sad.
Yes. Very, very sad. So then, Arnold took the stand and recanted his entire confession.
Oh my God. Pick a lane, man.
Pick a fucking lane. So basically, he stated that the Lexington police had deliberately mixed up his words in the confession that they wrote down on his behalf, and that a lot of what they said isn't true.
No, I'm just confused.
I think where my head went with a lot of this guy was a raging alcoholic, okay? And if you withdraw from alcohol, you can hallucinate. I mean, you hallucinate, you're sick, you're puking. I mean, you get sick, you're physically sick. A lot of the times they say, and this is from watching Intervention, you have to wean yourself off of it because you can literally give yourself a seizure, swallow your own tongue, and die.
That's dramatic.
It is. But I was kind of like, this guy had been weaning off for 7 days. You would think he'd be fine, but there is no way to prove that.
Sure.
He could have easily been hallucinating all of this stuff. So in the detective's defense, they stood by their statement and said that there were things that only a person who murdered Betty would know. But that's false because they released all of this information. But they also, when they initially got there, they interviewed him the first day. And then he was visibly upset and shaking and sweating and was not in a good place. So they didn't take an official statement that day. They allowed him to sleep, go back to his cell, get it together. And then they took his official statement the next day where he was much calmer and much more together.
Okay.
And did give him the chance.
Sounds like they did the right thing.
They did give him a chance to kind of get it together before anything was official on record. So in their defense, I think that was, it's rare to hear that. Right. Normally it's just like, confess, confess, confess. And then they came back in and they literally did this in 2 hours. It would seem to have been standard questions about what happened, and it was very smooth sailing, I guess. You know what I mean? Two hours is not really a long time to get a confession on a breakdown of everything that happened. I digress. Then his aunt took the stand and testified that he was with her and actually gave him an alibi for the day of the murder.
What the fuck?
And that was, I was like, okay, okay.
Wait, did she testify for the plaintiffs or the defense? Because...
No, the defense.
Okay. So, obviously, they didn't know this was coming. And then they were like, what the fuck?
Well, I mean, you have to release who you're gonna...
Right.
You know. So, right. I'm sure they had an idea, but I don't understand why she didn't immediately go to the police station and
that
say...
That would make me scratch my head.
Yeah.
If but, I was the judge, if I was anyone involved, I would go...
Right.
Why wasn't this something that was said...
Right away.
Beforehand.
Exactly.
But I digress.
I mean, again, it's not fucking 2021.
It doesn't have to
be
2021.
No, no, no. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying... No, it is, though. I'm saying that she might have not heard of this or heard about this for a specific amount of time. There's no texting. There's no anything like that. You know what I mean? So news traveled a lot slower back then than it does now.
You're right.
So why she didn't react right away, it might have taken her a little bit of time to hear about what was going down. But still weird that it took to the trial for this shit to come to light.
Sure. Okay.
I mean, they basically stood by what they said. You know, they stated that he pointed out a specific gash on her head, but again, that was in the paper. There was specific things that, you know, weren't really, I mean, you know, pictures and papers aren't that great, you know.
Sure.
Clarity-wise, especially back then. So I think they basically were like, you know, he said some things that only he would know, but at the same time,
everything was
released. So it's like, you can't say that. He could have easily read a paper. Either way.
All right.
So it was a lot of back and forth. A lot of crazy shit happened. But the weirdest thing about all this was it was all banking on this confession, and there was no other evidence. None. Not one shred of evidence linking Arthur to this crime.
No. I don't see how that's even possible then.
It's so much reasonable doubt. Like, you can't put someone... And they were going to try for the death penalty.
Oh, my God. No. That is not enough. All right. Well, right. So, okay. Continue and tell me what happens. Because I'm losing my mind over here.
The jury deliberated for 6 hours and 45 minutes before announcing they were hung on a 7-5 vote. It was a hung jury and Arnold was released.
That sounds right. Because I mean, that's just not enough evidence.
It's not enough evidence.
I mean, imagine if he was innocent. That is not enough evidence.
And it's not... Okay. It's also like he wasn't well. I mean, was he crazy? No. Was he doing well? No. No. He was homeless, alcoholic veteran who went through the Korean War, who probably had PTSD.
Yep.
Who was self-medicating, clearly... No. So he was released. The indictment remained open until 2/2/1973, so February 2nd, 1973. During that time, they could have retried him. They were like, no. I mean, there's just not enough evidence other than this person who was not well, who confessed to this, that could just easily be like, I'm sick of being on the streets. I can get jail time forever. You know what I mean? It's just one of those things where they were like, there's not enough physical evidence in this for us to even attempt to retry this and have it go better than what it did.
Right.
So nothing was ever retried.
Nope. All right. Well, and that's that.
So
wrap it up with a bow.
Yeah. Just
or boop. Without a bow, I should say.
What, I mean, whatever you want to do.
It's just done.
So Arnold lived in Lexington, Kentucky until his death at age 49. He died on June 18th, 1980.
From what?
They didn't say.
Probably alcoholism?
Cirrhosis, maybe.
Yep.
Or some other random, crazy, you know, alcohol-related illness. But I will bring this up because I was like, ooh, interesting. So, I don't know when this was brought to the attention of other people or the Lexington police, but another suspect in the case was named, and he was a serial killer by the name of Nolan Ray George, who had murdered women around Ohio, Kentucky, and Michigan in the 1980s. They said it was unlikely that it was George, especially for the death of Betty, but there was no little evidence. You can't prove it otherwise unless he actually confesses. But again, everything was released in the paper. But his claim to fame was strangling his victims with items of clothing like pantyhose and socks.
Damn, that'd be right there. Especially if the bra was sitting there for him.
Right? So this is
nice and pretty.
Yeah, right?
Waiting for the neck.
Right when I said that, I was like, ooh. But it is still an open investigation, but it's considered a cold case.
Well, yeah.
No leads or nothing else. Years. Yep. Have been discovered.
What a story, man.
What God a story. Bless. It was that's what I told Katie. I'm like, it goes to a lot of states. There's a lot of crazy shit that happens in between it. But I feel like older cases, that's kind of it's what happens. Because there isn't like a system that you can type in. You get a lead, you write it on a fucking
day.
No, that's what I mean. That's what I meant. Like older cases where you like you write it on a fucking post-it note and you head out to fucking Michigan because you have to talk to this person.
Right.
You know, it's not like you can type in CODIS or look in, you know, the systems we have now.
Right.
That'll give you some information regarding who you're going to, whatever. Let me cite my sources. Ooh. You know what I am going to bring up that I didn't during this because I wasn't sure where it was going to go and nothing really came about. But so a few months after all this happened, a lead came in regarding a newspaper delivery truck driver. He stated that about 2 weeks before the murder, he delivered his papers at night, obviously, before, you know, people
got up.
Right.
Yeah.
And he drove right by the campus transy dorms. On this night, he saw a strange man standing on the corner of a street, and a small car was driving in front of them, and when he saw this car, the man rushed into the street and screamed, Betty. And the car stopped. The guy talked to her at her driver's side window, and then he got into the passenger side. They then turned off the road into the driveway right in front of Morrison Hall, where Betty's body was found. He also stated that a few nights after this, he saw the same car driving to the front of Morrison Hall, but this time the car had two women in it. So it was Betty and another woman.
So Betty's a swinger.
The delivery man's helper actually corroborated this story and said exactly what the delivery driver said and said this happened. Very suspect. Very weird. They said that this guy was 6 feet tall, dark-haired, was in a flannel and jeans, and that was it.
So
that was another weird little, huh.
Wait, but I'm confused, because they followed up on so many leads that they didn't follow up on this one?
They tried. What can you do?
Ugh, God.
You know what I mean?
That was probably him.
They looked around, but, I mean, he's 6 foot brown hair, wearing a flannel shirt.
Wait, I thought this was a ginger.
No, that was the other one. This was a whole other story, which is why I didn't bring this one up, because they did try and look into this, but nothing came of it, and it was just, but I thought it was interesting. Thought it was very interesting that these people saw this happen and no one could identify. But, you know, it could have been someone, it could have been a friend, but it's also kind of a weird, you're standing in a dark corner at like 12 at night.
Listen, if you're standing in a dark corner at 12 at night, get the fuck out of the fucking corner.
Well,
stop being a weirdo, unless you're just a weirdo and that's what you want to do. But otherwise, Can we not?
Well, it's really weird because it sounded like he was waiting on her to leave. So he had to have been watching her because it did not seem...
Listen, just stop being weirdos.
Well, it didn't seem that he was known. Like, he wasn't waiting for her to, like, pick him up. He was waiting for her to drive by and then completely surprised her and was like, Betty, who knows? But I just thought it was weird because it seemed like he was watching her. And knew where she was going to be. And it wasn't planned that she was picking him up because she would have stopped without him screaming her name.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that was fishy. But I thought I'd bring that up because I was like, huh. Just like the lipsticks on her shorts. And it was never brought up again that there was lipstick on her shorts.
Yep.
Who put it there? Not her.
Her lover.
That's what it made me think, more or less, that she could have been gay. And just been trying to hide it and picked up whoever it was and went to go do a little and shit went sideways. But
I mean, sideways for real.
For real. It's so sad. It was such a sad. I actually was crying when I was reading the book because they talk about her funeral. Could you imagine
being her lover and this is what happened when you escaped the car?
If that did happen, God. I would, I would not run away. I would go get a stick and hit this dude in the face.
Okay, but you don't know until you're in this situation.
I mean, I
wouldn't
just desert her. I would try to go get help.
Well, don't victim blame. But.
Yeah, I guess at the end of the day,
you don't know.
You were, if it was, because her parents adamantly believed that she was not gay and that she had dated people, but as we know, just because you're dating boys doesn't mean that you are not gay.
It's true.
I mean,
it's true even now until someone's ready to come out. So, right. I mean.
Right. So, it was a very weird story, and I kind of was very into it because it was a very weird story. Like, it just doesn't make sense in any aspect, like, any facet of my brain. She was well-regarded and was known to be, like, a very timid, very, very church-going, very smart girl. And out of nowhere.
And there's no rhyme or reason.
Yeah. No, and then rape, it was, like, her no bra robbery, was off. No. But she wasn't raped. So I think it could have been the period thing where her boobs just hurt and she wanted to take off her bra. But what the fuck happened?
I don't know, man. That's wild.
It's a crazy story. The murder itself just blows my mind. But I never say this, and I need to say this. It's still a cold case. I know it's very old now, but if anybody has any information, contact the Lexington frickin' Police Department. Because they're still researching it, and people still, they're still pulling up leads and stuff, but so far nothing has panned out. So if you know anything, contact some people, man. So I'm going to cite my sources. Who Killed Betty Gail Brown by Robert Lawson, who was the co-counsel on Arnold's defense team. He wrote a great book. Like I said, some of it droned on a little bit, like lawyer-wise. As we know, lawyers speak a lot, but it was very good. TransyRambler.com, Kentucky.com, Genie.com, KentuckyPress.com, and Reddit, obviously.
Bravo. Great story. I mean, a terrible story, but right. You told it great.
I hope there wasn't too much information. I was a little worried because it was 10 pages of stuff, so I hope it wasn't too much.
No, it was good. It was very good.
Thank you, my friend.
And then I will lighten the mood. Okay. You want a joke?
Katie's corny corner.
No. What did the fisherman say to the magician, pick a card, any card.
I just literally was like, I was hoping I would get it if it was involving fish, but I like it. Pick a card, any card.
Cod, for those of you who don't know, is a kind of fish.
It is. It's a white fish, and I enjoy it.
Well, there you have it.
It's very delicious. That was a good one, as always.
Yep.
Appreciate your dad jokes. They're my favorite.
Here for days.
Always. Tip your waitresses.
Tip me.
Oh, I have to. Yeah, right. Okay. I have to. Like, subscribe, review. We're at nobody.noproblem on Insta. We're at nobody.noproblem on Facebook. We are on all sorts of podcast platforms. Mm-hmm. So subscribe. And, give us a review. 5 stars. Avi. Oh, and a huge shout out to Sarah.
Yes.
For the little snippet. Which we enjoyed.
Yeah. I enjoyed all of the audio messages
quite a few
that you left.
As did I. They were very funny.
So thanks so much for listening, guys.
Yeah, we hope you liked today's episode. As usual, we'll be back either Monday or Tuesday. It should be Monday, because this episode's really long. I will, get it to you guys as soon as we can. We will be back next week with Katie telling another tale of murder and mayhem.
Yes.
I'm excited.
All the times. All right. Have a good night, everybody.
Yep. We will catch you guys on the flip side. I am Kristen.
I'm Katie.
We are nobody, no problem.
Adios.
Bye.